Hi, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? How have time and experience changed the way they feel about the way they look? Today's guest is Jo Wiley. Jo is a TV and radio presenter who grew up in Northamptonshire. Her media career began mostly behind the scenes, including producing a show on BSB and booking bands for Channel 4's The Word. Jo earned her place in the Britpop firmament by presenting Radio 1's evening sessions alongside Steve Lamacq. Through the heady days of Cool Britannia, going on to present her own Saturday show and becoming the first female presenter of the Radio 1 chart show. In 2011, she left Radio 1 after 17 years to join Radio 2, and for many years has presented coverage of music festivals, including, of course, Glastonbury. Jo has recently spoken about how going to the gym helped her deal with the impact of the menopause. So how does she feel about her body now? And how did she navigate the rampant objectification of women back in the Lad Mag era? Please welcome Jo Wiley. And thank you to our wonderful series sponsor, Clinique, where great-looking skin begins.
I ate a jacket potato on Sunday night that was really crispy, and I didn't chew it properly, and it really scratched down my throat, and my throat's been really, really sore ever since.
No, it's like a jacket potato abrasion.
Of all the freak
I'm
accidents.
Prepared to suffer for a jacket, though, aren't you?
I was really happy that it was so crispy. It was the best jacket potato I've eaten in a long, long time, so the crispiness was good, but not now.
I once delayed an interview with a very famous model who was in New York. I've never done this before, but I delayed an interview I was about to do with her because my jacket potato had just reached optimum crispiness. And I thought, oh, I could just enjoy my jacket potato and then speak to her in half an hour. The things we'll do for a jacket.
That's getting your priorities right.
I know, I think so. I can't even say I was old at the time either. Can you remember the first time you ever really became aware of your appearance?
Of my appearance? Oh my gosh. Blimey, that's a really good question. I can't really. It never mattered. My appearance never really mattered when I was a kid and when I was a teenager.
Tell me about that. Did it not matter to your parents? Because I think that's often a through line in these things.
No, you see, I remember my mum's appearance because my mum was really glamorous. Like,
tell me about her.
Really stylish, really, really stylish. She is to this day, but always had really short hair. She was like, she used to model for the most famous hairdresser in Northampton, John Richardson's, and I thought she was super cool. But it did mean that she used to dress me, actually. So maybe I was aware of my appearance because I always had really short hair. So all the photographs that you see of me when I was a kid, I've either got a feather cut or a pixie cut, and I don't particularly suit a pixie cut, so I just look like a boy. But I remember my mum, she used to do a lot of charity and fundraising, so she'd have charity balls, and I used to love watching her get ready for them because she had amazing nails, and they'd be crimson or scarlet, burgundy, all those colours, and then the lipstick would always match, so she'd got great lips and she used to colour those, and lovely earrings. So I just remember always thinking, God, my mum is so cool and so classy.
And what would little Jo be doing? Would you be sitting and watching her get ready?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I do. I definitely remember putting on the nail varnish and doing the lipstick and just watching her and then seeing her go out for the night. But it was never anything that I wanted to emulate. I did never want to do that. I wasn't particularly interested in makeup at all, apart from my girls' world, which I had, obviously. But not on myself. I didn't really practice.
Did you do the classic thing of cutting a fringe in and then regretting it on the girls' world?
No, I think my sister did that. My sister used to scalp my girls' world, and obviously then...
Yeah. Biro on the...
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah.
So you weren't interested so much. What were you interested in?
I used to swim, so I it was actually very practical having really short hair. So, I didn't ever wore makeup particularly. I just used to do swim training and then do galas, and God, I think the first time I probably got into makeup was going to Miss Selfridge.
Yes.
I mean, as you know, anybody
amazing
my age.
Amazing makeup brand back in the day, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, it was the best. Yeah. So it was in Northampton. I go to the town centre, and it would be like going to the best sweet shop in the world. And they have those little files of glitter. It's just like the most beautiful colours. They're all pastel, but shimmering, iridescent.
Yeah.
And just putting them on your hand and like being unable to decide which one you were going to choose. And then, oh, so that was my introduction to makeup.
I think that Miss Selfridge was very much the gateway beauty drug for kind of cool girls who loved their music and loved their clothes. It was like, it was such a moment going to the Miss Selfridge beauty counter, wasn't it? It just seemed so elevated and glam.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. No, it was the highlight of my week. It really was. It was a Saturday morning bus trip into town. And then, just looking at everything that was on offer.
Can you remember Copper Knockers lipstick from Miss Selfridge?
There
was a really famous lipstick from Miss Selfridge called Copper Knockers, and it made everybody look dead, basically. It was like this.
Oh, was it kind of purple or bluey grey?
It was like a sort of, it was technically a copper, but it had loads of grey in it. It was horrible. It was,
yeah.
It made you look as though your circulation had gone.
Yeah. No, there are definitely photographs of me, whether it was that one or not. But yeah, I definitely went through a metallic purple, blue, silver, grey kind of lipstick phase, which was, not very flattering. Not for a pale blonde girl.
And so did that kickstart a period of kind of experimentation and self-expression, do you think, with clothes and makeup and so on?
With makeup, yeah. And I used to go to my friend Barbara's house and we'd take it in turns making each other up. And she obviously was exquisitely beautiful and pretty. And I just always felt like the ugly duckling. And I remember I have this memory of her turning around to me at one point and just going, it's a shame about your nose. You know, when you're a kid,
girls.
You're like, oh, God.
And what was the shame about your nose you never found out?
Oh, well, no, I don't like my nose now. So it was it was just like pointing something out that I was really aware of. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And so, I think I've tried to compensate.
Why do girls do this?
I don't know.
It's terrible, isn't it? I had one friend called Sarah Davis who decided one night, or between ourselves, we decided that a great game we should play is tell each other what our best and worst features were. So you can imagine where that went.
Oh, my God.
Two little girls in tears at the end of it. Why do we do this stuff?
And a lifelong hang up.
Yeah,
literally.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I suppose the world bullies us into it.
Yeah.
You loved music from a fairly early age, didn't you? You kind of knew that that's what turned you on.
Yeah, So I used to go to gigs with probably the boys who were in like the sixth form and I was in the fifth year, and I'd tag along with them. In terms of makeup, I don't think I even wore makeup then. I think it was never an issue. I was just going along because I was really excited about the music. So,
and what kind of bands would you go and see?
I went to see The Clash. That was the first really exciting gig that I went to. I went wearing some little tiny red pumps and then left without them because they just got lost.
Sign
somewhere.
Of a good gig.
Yeah. And then, who else did I see? Depeche Mode. That was quite an early one. So, just going to see the bands was what it was all about, going to see the music. I've just remembered I saw the Rubettes, who were when I was tiny, like really, really young, because my aunt worked in the entertainment business. And so she got me to meet the Rubettes. And I remember, in terms of appearance, being like going again to Northampton Town Centre, and we didn't have many shops. We had Miss Selfridge, we had Chelsea Girl.
Yeah.
And Tammy, was that?
Tammy Girl and Etam.
Tammy Girl, that's it. And went to Tammy Girl, and they just had a new, this new stock arrive. And I remember choosing my outfit, especially for what I was going to wear to the Rubettes. And there's a photograph of me with my skinhead. And then this, I can remember the outfit to this day. It was kind of browny, orangey colour, and it had like big sleeves. And that was
exciting. Kind of leg of mutton.
Yeah. And then a little kind of pleated skirt. I can remember the feeling of buying that outfit and then wearing it. It was just so exciting.
Did you have any instinct then to be in front of cameras, to be visible? Because I know you started out in the industry very much behind the scenes. And so was it not something that appealed to you to kind of be front and centre and seen in the way that you became later on?
I mean, it never entered my head to be in front of the camera. I remember doing the evening session and you have to do promotion for it. And so Steve and I would go out and we'd do photographs. And that was my first experience of having my photograph taken for publicity and just like being completely all at sea. Like the whole concept of a photo shoot was so, there was nothing I'd experienced or ever thought or dreamt about doing. So they were quite painful in the beginning. Yeah, I mean, they're quite often painful.
I spoke to you about this ages ago because obviously I've interviewed you a couple of times before. And I remember you saying to me something like, that when you look at photos back then, you just think, where are my eyebrows?
Yeah, oh my God, yeah. No, eyebrows I discovered very late in life, but no.
Like Madonna.
Yeah.
Says she discovered eyebrows too late.
Really? Mm. Oh, wow. Yeah, whereas now, you know, my daughter who's 16, it's all about the eyebrows and it has been for quite a long time.
Yeah.
I wish I'd knew at that age. Maybe if anyone ever asks me, what did you wish you knew when you were 13, it'll be about eyebrows.
I find that most regrets are eyebrow related.
Really? Like, yeah.
Well, you've overplucked them or you haven't plucked them enough. Or...
Yeah. See, my mum has got very, very sketchy eyebrows. So I'm always saying to Coco, don't overpluck those eyebrows. Yeah. And there will come a day when they won't grow back.
And I'm kind of sad about it forever. Mm. So when you entered radio, we were talking about this when you walked in here today, because you said, oh, I should probably get changed because we're being filmed. And we were moaning about the fact that now so much kind of audio media is filmed and how disappointing that is. Tell me about that. There's something about radio that really appeals to the invisible instinct in us, isn't there?
Yeah, because you relax. You've got nothing to... Yeah. You can be your true authentic self. You don't have to act and be anybody at all. So there's no artifice at all. You can just say what you want and you feel relaxed. You know, and that goes with me when I'm interviewing bands. So many of them come in and if they see a camera, they're like, oh God, I remember when radio just used to be about talking to a microphone. And people act differently, you know. Just interviewing someone, you have to put on a performance. So when there's a camera, you have to perform. When there's just a microphone, you can just be yourself. And that's the joy of it.
Yeah, it's that George Orwell thing, isn't it? The audience of one, where you feel like you're just chatting to one other person. You're not really aware of the rest of the world hearing in.
And radio is all about talking to one other person, isn't it?
Or,
that's your audience. You're speaking to that person in their bedroom, in their kitchen, in their car. And you can do that quite freely. Whereas when there are cameras there, it's just it's a show. It's a different thing. So you have to put it out of your head. You know, my worst case scenario now is when we see things back, you know, because everything's filmed and you'll suddenly see this thing on Instagram, a pop-up that's been posted and you're like, oh God, that angle.
Yeah.
Because I've never had to think about angles and, you know, oh, I just hate it.
And so how was it? Because I know you do love your TV work as well. And so how was that transition? What were the kind of points of discomfort when that happened?
What, of doing TV?
And... of moving from radio over to being people looking at you, people looking at
your face. It's just been a very, very long, painful journey to where
Tell
I
me.
Am right now. Oh, just, you know, I'm really, really grateful now that I've worked with lots of different people who've helped me look the way I am now. So whether that's my makeup artist, who is a wonder, and she's a wonder because she paints my face, but also she's my mate and she'll tell me when things look terrible.
We should give Liz a shout out.
Her name is Liz Beckett, and she is incredible. But she's an ally. She's on your side. So when you're feeling a bit rubbish and you've got to do something that's in front of an audience, she's just there kind of supporting you and helping you. So people like that are really important. And it's finding those people. So now I will always want to work with Liz because she's my support network. But you go through a lot of people who are not Liz. I've had a lot of bad makeup in the past. And it's because I don't know my face and I just let people do things that don't necessarily suit me. And now I'm older, I know what suits me and what doesn't.
I'm very interested in this, you don't know your face. Why do you think you don't know your face? Do you avoid watching yourself back on things? Obviously, as you say, you sometimes get a nasty surprise on social or whatever.
Yeah.
But for the most part, would you avoid looking at yourself? On
yeah. 100%. Yeah. No, I never want to see myself back. And I know a problem. Maybe I should, to kind of learn how to look and what to do, but I just don't particularly want to do that because I think I'm a radio girl at heart.
Yeah. Yeah, so, I think this is normal. I think you are either a radio person or a TV person instinctively, regardless of what you enjoy.
Yeah, just going by your very nature. And I've never been one to pose for photographs to know what shapes to pull or how or faces to pull. Whereas again, you know, my daughter, my 16-year-old's generation, they've perfected the looks that you do to camera and they study themselves and the whole TikTok generation. It's a whole other thing that is... It just blows my mind, really. And they're quite happy to study their face and to know what suits them best, which is, I find it fascinating.
I mean, it's funny, we're sort of quick, aren't we, as older people to jump on that stuff and say, oh, it must be so hard for them to be scrutinising themselves. But on the other hand, there's a degree of comfort they have with looking at themselves that we didn't have.
Yeah, no, it definitely gives them confidence, absolutely. I mean, obviously, they've got the joy of filters and all kinds of technology that helps, which means that they're presenting kind of, it's not their true self, is it? It's an image that they're presenting.
You have two girls, and I know you have boys too, but I suppose the nature of what we're talking about, there's a certain level of scrutiny that applies to girls that is just never going to apply to boys. I find it interesting you have these two girls that are of different generations, right?
Oh, me too.
So you have a millennial mm-hmm. and you have a Gen Z girl. Have you observed any differences between them re all of that stuff and their perception, their
absolutely.
Self-image?
Yeah, I mean, you know, a 16-year-old is incredibly savvy and really knows how to present herself, knows how to put on makeup. India is my older daughter and she's just 32, I think, now. So I kind of went through she'll kill me. She's really good at putting on makeup. Mm. She went through that whole phase and she's very artistic and very, very creative. So she did all that, but she just doesn't care now. She's just mm-hmm. a different person altogether and makeup is not massively her thing. But she's extremely different to the generation, the millennials right now. I don't know. She's just much, much more natural, much less self-conscious and less manicured. She's going to kill me.
I feel that women who are in their 30s now almost had the worst of it in terms of what they were shown, they were shown in kind of magazines and on TV and the kind of headlines that were written around women. They were savage, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. No, I was trying to think of the difference now and there was so much body shaming and that weighed heavily on India and her generation. There was, you know, it was every message that you saw in the press, in the TV, everywhere in the media was just about the shape that you are, the size you are. So she was extremely conscious of the way she looked and unhappy for quite a long time. It's really sad. It was very, very sad what she and her generation went through and how they punished themselves and gave themselves a really, really hard time. And it's only now that she's got the confidence and she's really happy in her own skin and it's just joyful to see what she's like now. But she's had some I just think they suffered at the hands of all the mixed messages they got in the media.
I think you must have done too, though, because you were working successfully in the media in the 90s, at a time when there were really specific requirements for women in the media, right? You almost kind of had to be one of the lads, but also really glam and also really pretty. And by the way, could you just wear a bikini as well? How did you manage to, I feel like you dodged a lot of those bullets in your career. Was that a conscious and calculated decision on your part?
It wasn't conscious, it wasn't calculated. I think it's just my personality that, you know, this was the loaded era that mm-hmm. was going on. So people like Sarah and Zoe, they're a bit younger than me, maybe that helped. Uh-huh. And they were also in a different, you know, I was very, very rooted in music. So it was kind of okay to be a music fan and to wear DMs, which I've always done, and trainers, and not go down the glam route. I'm not a glam person. I haven't got amazing boobs. I haven't got nobody asked me to wear a bikini. Nobody asked me to get my boobs out. So it just was never an issue. I was very, very lucky like that. So I was able to remain true to myself. And I've always known the kind of clothes that I like. Which are what? Comfortable clothes. Look at me here now.
But I think lots of women my age, your age, somewhere in between would consider you, and I would as well, quite a clothes horse, really. You're somebody for whom clothes seem to be really important.
Yeah, I think
it's a considered look.
Yeah, it's a considered look. I've got this, I think, from my mum because she is and always has been so stylish. So I've always known the value of having one or two really nice bits of clothing, and that's always been my golden rule. So I would much rather spend a lot more money on something that's great that I'm going to wear for the rest of my life than buy millions of bits of clothes. I can't bear that. So my wardrobe is quite pared down.
So what would an example of such a garment be?
My favourite thing in my wardrobe is a Chloe dress that I wore to the Brits to present an award to Keen, I think it was. And it was just this beautiful turquoise satin dress. It was very skimpy, for me. And it tied up around the neck and it showed off.
I know that dress.
Oh my God.
You looked absolutely beautiful in that dress.
That was the most money I've ever spent on anything. And I remember going out and buying it and nearly being sick when I spent the money. But it's in my wardrobe now, you know, yeah. And I will wear it again. I'll give it to Coco to wear. And, you know, it's a treasured piece. It really is. But I've always known what I liked. I know I like that colour. I know I like textures. They're always really important to me. And I like comfort. So, yeah, here I am in my trainers and my fluffy jumper and, you know, joggers. And that's kind of me.
Do you feel like you've grown into your image, though? I feel like you're one of those odd people who looks better year on year.
Oh, thank you.
I think again, it's true.
But I think it comes with being older and being experienced and learning what suits me. And, you know, yeah, just I know the shops that I like to go to. I trust all the people who work in the boutiques that I go to. So they're like curators, aren't they?
Yeah.
And so you go to a boutique and I love the women that run these different boutiques that I go to. And I know that they're going to have stuff that I will like. And because I'm in the position, I'm very, very lucky that I can spend money on nice clothes. So, yeah, I probably do look better than I did years ago because I've just learned. I've learned what suits me and I know what doesn't suit me.
Have there been times where you've been wearing sort of almost the wrong face or the wrong outfit and it's really impacted how you've moved around that day at work or when you feel wrong, you just sort of do wrong?
I don't think so. The only thing I ever remember wearing is this horrible green satiny thing to an Enemy Awards once. And my husband said to me before I went out, are you really wearing that? And I was like, yes, especially now you've said that.
A few years ago, I was interviewing a couple of the girls from All Saints. And they were saying that they look back and they're so grateful that they were really the last wave of female celebs who were allowed to just wear baggy trousers and vest tops without being kind of pulled up about it. And literally 6 months later, yeah. It was all of that stuff. It was all the kind of circle of shame stuff.
Yeah, Heat magazine.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. You know, it was one of those horrible things that you were addicted to, but also ashamed of. You know, we had this love-hate relationship with, didn't we?
Yeah, because it sort of appealed to that internal misogyny we felt about ourselves, didn't it?
No, the All Saints era was fantastic. And I guess I kind of used to wear the Maharishi trousers.
I mean, they just looked so great.
Yeah, they really did. Yeah, and they look comfortable. And when you're comfortable, you exude confidence, don't you? And, you know, you look a lot happier and better.
Do you feel more confidence, exude more confidence since you embraced fitness? To give some context here, your women's health cover was such a moment. I hope you're really proud of that because everybody stopped in their tracks when they saw that cover to see a woman of a certain age looking so strong and healthy and vibrant and happy and sexy was such a moment.
Wow. Thank you.
Did you know how much run up to that cover did you have?
Oh my God, not long. Because
God, it's making me feel sick.
No, because you say am I proud of it? If I'd had 6 months notice, I would have looked a lot better than I did on that cover.
I would have worked a lot harder.
I could. I had about 6 weeks, I think, and I see a trainer at the gym and I was like, Adam, help, I've got to get, you know, I need to tone my arms, I need to do this, that, the other. And he was amazing and I worked hard. But you know, I was fit beforehand because I genuinely love swimming and I've always loved going to the gym. So that's always been a really big part of my life. But yeah, I could have looked better. I think.
What does exercise bring to your life other than amazing arms in that picture? But what has it brought to you emotionally and mentally, I suppose?
Clear head. You know, when I'm feeling particularly grumpy or miserable or worried about something, then I'll go for a swim. Swimming is the thing that I do more than anything and I love more than anything in the world. Yeah, the swimming is great because I used to do it when I was a kid. So it's just like going back to what I know. But also I like looking in the mirror and seeing that my arms look good. It makes me feel good about myself and gives me confidence, which I didn't have.
So tell me about that. What would you do as somebody who knows nothing about gyms and what one does in the gym? What would a session at the gym look like for you?
Do a swim and then I do weights. So weights is the thing that seems to be for women of my age at the moment. So I do lots of arm exercises and squats and goodness knows what, sit-ups.
Does being strong affect how you feel about yourself?
Yep, absolutely gives you confidence, yeah. No, I love the fact that I feel strong. I went through a period of time, and it was probably around the menopause, that I didn't have that confidence, and I felt, you know, muddled in my head because I just couldn't think clearly. So I would go swimming to try and give me that clarity. And then I just got to a point where I started on HRT, and that made me feel a lot better. And I realized that I needed to feel physically stronger because I was so used to being a swimmer mm-hmm. and having like nice big broad shoulders mm-hmm. and being able to pick up stuff and feel great. And that had gone. I just felt like I'd just become a little bit more fragile. So that's why I went to the gym and I started just working out and doing weights and getting fit and strong.
So the brain fog was the first bit, the lack of clarity. That's difficult in a job like yours because you need to have the word at the front of your head, right? Yeah. You need to reach for the word quickly, get it out.
Yeah, no, it's a horrible feeling when you're live on air and you're trying to formulate a sentence and just the words are going in all different directions and you just can't get them together to make a coherent sentence. It's really scary.
And could you tell what it was quite swiftly?
No, not at all. Because when I was going through it, the conversation wasn't like it is now, you know, it was just the beginning. You'd had great people like Mariella, I think, Mariella Frostrup kickstarted a lot of the conversation. Jenny Murray had also talked about it. And they were the people I kind of went to just go, you know, what's going on? I read everything that they said about it and decided that HRT was probably a good thing to do. And it was, for me personally, it was really great. Getting the right one took a while, but
trial and error.
Yeah.
We'll dive back in shortly after a quick thank you to our series sponsor, Clinique. Clinique's innovative clinical reality diagnostic tool determines your skin type and tells you which products in their iconic and trusted three-step routine are for you. I've done this myself and it is fascinating. The tool will also identify specific needs. In my case, dullness, dehydration and dark spots, and select the makeup products that work with your skin type, not against it. Clinique skincare and makeup products are dermatologist tested, allergy tested, and 100% fragrance free. Discover your best skin at Clinique, where great looking skin begins. I feel like there's so much talk about menopause, but so few women of profile talk about HRT.
Yeah, I know. Well, because it had such a stigma in the beginning of the fear of breast cancer, and still that is always at the back of your mind, I think. But the more educated we become and the more evidence and medical research is done, then I think there is more confidence in HRT. But it definitely takes a long time to get the right one, and to also, you know, it's not available to everybody and the right ones are not available. You know, I've had a lot of friends that I've said, well, this is the one that works for me. Go and ask your doctor for it. And they're just told that they can't access it or they can't get it. I'm like, really?
Yeah.
It's scandalous.
I know. It's a sort of two-tier system, isn't it?
Absolutely.
If you access the right doctor or if you live in the right postcode or you have the funds. I heard you say that you felt, I don't know if it was directly related to the brain fog or sense of physical vulnerability, but you felt quite fragile as a person there for a little while.
Yeah, I did. I just lacked confidence. I just felt I lost a sense of myself. I didn't really know who I was. And I was just unhappy. I just felt really unhappy and didn't really know what would make me happy. And I didn't know why I was unhappy either. And that's really confusing.
I think that's really key, that not knowing thing, because that's the thing that throws you, isn't it? You want a circumstance to improve or a situation to improve, but you don't have one. You just feel a bit crestfallen.
Yeah. Yeah. And you don't know who to turn to. You just don't know what to do. And because you're feeling so rubbish, you just can't be bothered, or you don't know where to turn. And I see that in lots of my friends. You know, it's really painful when you see people who are struggling. That's why it's important to have these conversations.
Were you ever worried during that time? I suppose it's a time where we're worrying about all sorts of things. Were you ever concerned about what will my place be as a woman in the media of a certain age? Is this it now for me that I'm not going to look the way I used to look, or I'm not going to think the way I used to think? It felt like the world hadn't really caught up at that point in a way that it perhaps has now.
I guess so. Maybe at the back of my mind, just wondering how long I'd keep going for. But you see, my role models were always people like Annie Nightingale and, you know,
radio has some good ones.
Yeah. And also people in music. You've still got, you know, Debbie Harry and Patti Smith and Chrissy Hynde and Charlene Spiteri and just all these fantastic women. So I was less worried about it, really. You'll probably gauge, I don't really think ahead too much. I'm a bit of a Winnie the Pooh. I don't plan anything. I've never planned anything in my life. I've just kind of bumbled along and hope for the best.
I know from talking to you before about things like skincare. I know you're really interested in things like skincare that you... Well, I suppose, why is that? Do you like the kind of self-care ritual of it? Do you like seeing the results? What is it about skin in particular that appeals?
I like all the pots and the potions and the kind of the smells and the scents. And again, I think it goes back to my mum and just having all that around. But also I want the best results on my face because, you know, as you get older, you want to look as good as you can. So I'm always looking for things that are going to give me good results. So that's why I speak to you.
Yeah.
It's really good because if we can all pass on this information, yeah. That's why I love what you do, because you're constantly saying, oh, this worked for me and this is really good, because I don't want to waste my time or my money on things that are not going to work for me. And there are lots of people out there making stuff that isn't great quality. So
yeah,
I do. I love makeup and I love skincare.
And so what have you loved? What are your hero products? The things that are always sitting nicely on your bathroom shelf?
Well, I think this goes back to Miss Selfridge and the shimmery, glittery files of eyeshadow and Charlotte Tilbury. I think their palettes are amazing. I've got so many of those.
So the little quads?
Yeah, the little quads. They're really good. The browns are just fantastic. So Pillow Talk, I get that over and over and over again. Lancôme, I love their mascara Definisil. I know. I've tried lots of others, but I always go back to that. Doesn't flake, doesn't smudge, none of that. Sisley, I really, really, really rate their lip balm and their skincare products. They're really great. And for nails, Nailberry. That's another thing I buy for all my girlfriends whenever it's birthdays, Christmases, because the colours are beautiful, jewel-like, just again, like Miss Selfridge. And they go on so beautifully and they don't chip.
There's something about, it's interesting that you mentioned you buying your girlfriend's Nailberry. There's something about the way Nailberry looks that just looks like a really luxe gift. I think the packaging is so chic, isn't it? It's so kind of clean and beautiful. They're like little jewels, as you say, you want to hold them.
I've got them lined up on my my drawers. Yeah, just all the different colours.
Do you do your own nails?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I much prefer to do my own nails. I get really irritated when people do my nails. Margaret Dabbs is amazing for pedicures. Can I just say, if anyone's thinking... Margaret Dabbs pedicures are fantastic, and probably the manicures. But
if you like a down and dirty treatment, Margaret Dabbs is great.
Yeah.
Do you like the scalpel out, everything? You want the work?
Yeah, I want it all off. Yeah, yeah. Like I say, I always want results. If I'm having anything done to my body at any point, I want to see results at the end of it.
Why do you not like having your nails done? Is it the feeling of sort of being out of action, of not having, not being able to use your hands when you want to?
No, I don't like the way they file my nails. I know very much, I know what I like, so I know the shape I like my nails to be. And so if they, you know, do corners or edges or they get rid of those, it just really, really irritates me. So I'm a very grumpy person to give a manicure to. So yeah, if you see me coming, just turn me away. What else? And then in terms of beauty products, and Victoria Beckham, I think, has been a revelation. Like her eye pencils are amazing. I bought them for so many of my friends. They're the best presents you could buy anybody.
I feel like I'd be interested in your thoughts, but I feel like what's been really great about that brand is the sort of respect it affords grown-ups. Feels grown-up. It feels like a thing for grown women. It doesn't feel like it's chasing kids.
No.
In the way that so much is.
Yeah. It's all about, you know, whether it works on your eyelids or your skin, whether the texture works or not. And they go on really easily. And yeah, they're just real hero products.
Yes, I feel a bit kind of paid attention to and seen as as a woman of 50. I feel like,
she's respecting the skin that you have.
Yeah.
I think is the key to her products.
And what about treatments? Do you ever find yourself able to nip out and have a facial or a massage or anything?
I have a facial. There's someone who works just across the road from me, this local girl, and she does amazing facials, which which has been fantastic because it's so local and so close to me. And her name's Georgina and she's really good. So that's, and you're going to ask, I don't even know what she does to me. I know there's a red light and then there's some microneedling.
So it's quite a technical facial.
It is a really technical facial, yeah.
So I think facials are divided into two types. They are either strokey, chakra building loveliness, or they are down and dirty.
Yeah, no, I want
results.
Let's
make things happen.
Yeah, I want results. No, I don't care about having needles put in me and and scrubbing all the dead stuff off. And I want to come out glowing and I want to kind of have as few lines as possible. Thank you very much indeed.
Yeah.
So no, when I see Georgina, I know that I'm going to come out of there and my skin is going to be plumped up and glowing and it lasts for a long time.
Yes, I don't want a pampering session. I want to look different.
Yeah, exactly. Well, because I am so busy all the time that if I just don't have the time or the patience to lie there on a bed and be stroked. I just don't. I want the results. I want to look great after.
You mentioned Liz Beckett earlier a couple of times. So Liz, as we mentioned, is your makeup artist. She's also Lauren Laverne's makeup artist. She's lots of, basically, if there's a woman on telly who you think looks particularly great, there's a good chance it's Liz Beckett.
Yeah.
What have you learnt from her? What do you, there's a lot of time spent in the makeup chair, whether you're at Glastonbury or at the BBC or whatever. You must glean some stuff. What has been particularly useful?
Eyebrows. I think Liz has been great at teaching me eyebrows. To not to have them too wide. Really important to have them kind of coming in closer.
Starting too far over here?
You don't want too massive a gap there. So to bring in your eyebrows. It works for me anyway. She's taught me how to apply eyeshadow to wink because I've got very wide eyes, so I can wing out my eyes very, very far. So if ever anybody else does my makeup, I'm always like, no, you can take it wider. And they go, no, I don't think so. And I go, no, you can. Liz has told me. So I just always tell people to do what Liz does for me, really. And to smile and be myself, I think, is the most important thing.
She's quite, I think of her as quite a woman-friendly makeup artist. And what I mean by that is she seems to kind of steer into your face rather than try and change it.
Oh my God, yeah. No, the number of times I will say to her, oh, I really hate my nose. And she'll be like, you have an amazing face. And she'll really, really tell me off. And I'm like, okay, Liz, thank you.
Yeah, hype girl.
Yes. Yeah. She's absolutely a hype girl, yeah.
And when you go to Glastonbury, which I'm sure we'll see you again this year, you seem like such a fixture at Glastonbury. You and Lauren sitting on a hay bale is kind of what most people think of when they close their eyes and think of Glastonbury. What is your advice, even though I know you have a makeup trailer and you're not pretending otherwise, but what's your festival makeup tip?
Do you know, you said earlier on about eyebrows, and when I look back at the early days of Glastonbury when I was presenting, we didn't have makeup then at all. It was just literally me and John Peel sitting on some straw, and I have no eyebrows at all. I mean, I don't think I've even got any makeup on. Can you imagine going on television wearing no makeup?
I know.
God. But I looked really happy and I was having a great time, so it didn't really matter, but it's changed so much. So my festival tip, it's always... I don't know, hair bands, tying your hair up, wearing a hat, because the hair is always a major issue.
Yes, it just gets dirtier and dirtier and dirtier, doesn't
it? Yeah, it really does. You know, and I can't lie, but I leave the site and I go home and I have a shower. I have to have a shower. I'm obsessive about showering every morning and washing my hair, no matter how many times I'm told that you should never wash your hair too often. But once or twice a day is fine by me.
So you're a clean hair always person.
100%. I hate having dirty hair.
It's a horrible feeling, isn't it?
Oh my God, I feel unclean, yeah.
Yeah.
I saw Liz this morning and she was like, when did you last wash your hair? Obviously this morning. And she was horrified. I just can't leave the house. I just feel horrid.
I always think if you've got dirty hair, you cannot stop thinking about it the whole day. It's just on your mind the whole time.
Yeah, I know. I just feel like I want to apologise to everybody all the while. I feel like I don't look very nice at all. My hair is always an issue because of the swimming. So my hairdresser, who is an amazing guy called Joel, who works at Nicola Clark at John Frieda, mm-hmm. He's done my hair for so long.
He's a brilliant hairdresser. Much loved within the beauty press.
Oh, really?
He's so respected, yeah.
Oh, God. Well, he's one of my oldest friends. I love him. And John, there's another guy called John who colours my hair. But I get told off so much. Joel's just like, how have you been swimming again? I'm like, yes, I have. I can't stop swimming. Look at your hair. It's look at this. And you're like, hold up strands of my hair. Look, this is chlorine damage. This is chlorine damage. So I have to seek out all the best chlorine, anti-chlorine shampoo that I possibly can. So Paul Mitchell is a good one. I think it's number 3 I use.
Good old Paul Mitchell's.
Yeah.
Such a great brand. Swimming has come up a few times. It's obviously such an important part of your life. I know this idea of kind of embracing the outside world and feeling alive has become really important to you in the past few years. You had a sad, bad run, didn't you, of bereavement?
Yeah, oh God, yeah.
You had a stinker of a run of losing people you loved very much and close colleagues and old close friends. Has that made you... more health conscious? Has that made you more aware of preserving the body you're in?
Yeah, no, it was a massive wake-up call. We lost about four people in very quick succession, and they were, you know, people our age. They were blokes our age, and they all, you know, it was a variety of different things that felled them at the end. It was brain tumours, it was cancer, it was COVID, it was the whole lot. But they'd all got young kids our age, my yeah. children's age. And it's been horrific seeing those kids having to grow up without dads.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, all of a sudden it was like, oh my God, I've got to be here for as long as I can possibly be. So therefore I'm going to revise my diet. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to get health checks all the time just to catch anything early if it happens. So that's what I've done. And also my husband, Steve, it's been really, really important. And also, you know, just the whole thing about seize the day and don't wait and enjoy every second, all those stupid old cliches. But when you lose people, you know why they're cliches.
Cliches are cliches for a reason,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
I mean, are you almost 35 years married
yeah.
to Steve? Yeah. Thereabouts, or is it 35?
I can't even remember.
See, that's a good sign.
Yeah. It must be about 33, 34, I think. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. 30. I think we've known each other for 34. We got married really quickly.
Famously a very happy marriage. How has it been interesting to grow older with another human being and see one another age? Have you valued that process of seeing each other like that?
I guess we're just partners for life, really. You just kind of, you grow up and you have fun together and you fall out together and you raise your kids and your family time is incredibly precious and you cherish all those moments together. So, and you take each other for granted probably. And then there are times when you have enormous amount of fun. So it's a mixed bag, I think. It's, you know, especially losing friends, I've realised how lucky I am, and he's an amazing dad and an amazing energy. He's like, everybody loves Disco Steve. He's just got this reputation for being incredibly life affirming, and that's how we complement each other, I think, because I can be quite quiet and calm and shy and all those things, and he's just this very larger than life character.
There's this huge, I really hate to call it a trend because it really should just be a sea change. But there's lots of talk at the moment about this idea of anti-aging being replaced by longevity, a feeling of feeling as good as you can for as long as you can. Have you observed that change in yourself, the women around you, the industry you work in?
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
So this idea that longevity now is not about looking young for ages, it's about feeling great for ages. This
yeah.
this shift of focus of, actually, I'm not going to pretend to be 30, I'm not going to try to look 30, I'm going to try to feel brilliant at 50, mm-hmm. or I'm going to try and future-proof, to a degree, my wellness so I keep feeling good. Have you always felt that way? It feels like that's how you live your life.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's been instinctive for you, or whether that's come to you later.
I think it's a mixture of both. I think it's kind of instinctive, but also the fact that I have been made to think about, because I get interviewed a lot about all the fitness that you do, and it's made me appreciate that, yeah, the fitness that I do is actually trying to future-proof my health and so that I'm around for as long as I possibly can, but also that I feel good. We've got a lot of arthritis in our family. So I've seen my mum and dad and my grandma and the rest of my family seen how it's impacted them as they've got older. So I think I've always had this awareness of mm-hmm. I'm not going to be as able in the future to do these things. So I've got to do them now. So that's why I've done triathlons. That's why I've done open water swimming. That's why I've done half marathons, because I can do it now. And I know that, you know, my dad had to stop playing football because he had rheumatoid arthritis when he was really young. And so I've always had this awareness that it's very important to do what you can while you can.
One of the things about you that I think is really specific to you is that whenever there are lots of women your age, my age, older than you, who really rely on you and your presence and your visibility, the way you look really, really matters to them, because you're a great example of someone who just looks fantastic at any age, who's embracing life and being very visible. And one of the ways recently in which you've done that that's really, really resonated with lots of women I know are your 90s anthems yeah. nights. Tell me about those, because what I would love to talk about is the sort of power of dance because I really believe that having a dance has magic powers.
Oh my God.
How I feel.
The 90s anthems have, it's been a revelation because I've been doing it for quite a long time now. And it's evolved into this amazing thing. So when I walk out on stage now and I look out at the audience, there's just at the front, there's this sea of women who are gorgeous and fabulous and they look amazing. And they're so excited to be with their mates. I mean, they've all come with gangs of friends that they used to club with, you know, in the 90s.
Glitter, hair done.
Sequins, glitter, band t-shirts, and they are there. They're up for a party and they party from the second I walk out on stage till the second I walk off, and we're in it together. Honestly, I get so much out of doing those gigs because in the beginning they were scary and I'd go and do the shows and I'd be really nervous beforehand. But now I love it because I can see how good a time they're having, and it just feels like this kind of relationship that we're having while I'm on stage. I absolutely love it. And there are blokes there, there are guys there, and when the music changes, they kind of come forward and then they're all in together. It's a really, really brilliant experience.
A friend of mine came to one, which is when I first became aware of them. And she was saying it was just absolutely life affirming being surrounded by women roughly your age.
Yeah.
Having it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know, because kind of where else can you go? Like, yeah. You know, people can go and see, you can go to a gig, but it's quite focused. Whereas this, it's just an amazing release. It's a really good chance to, as I said, be with your friends that you used to go out to gigs with all those years ago, and to forget about all the stuff that's going on in your life that is bringing you down. Forget about the menopause, forget about the kids, forget about your husband, forget about your parents, all that stuff, and just go out there and dance and just forget it all. Love the music, love the songs, and for an hour and a half, have the best time. And that's what they are doing.
Dance?
I'm a terrible dancer. No, all I
but
can do.
You love it.
No, not really, because I'm so self-conscious. My mum has always told me I can't dance. And I, you know, that's why I was a goth, because you don't have to dance properly. You know, you can be a goth and all you do is slam dance. You do this. So I could do that. But no, I'm a really bad dancer. So for me, being exposed on stage, having to kind of do some sort of movement was in the beginning excruciating. Now I don't care.
You know. So it sort of healed you as well as the audience.
Yeah, I've learned a lot. I've really learned a lot doing those 90s anthem shows. It's given me so much. It's really empowered me. So I'm very thankful to all the people who come along to those gigs.
It just sounds like such a sisterhood. I've heard only good things. I'm definitely going to come.
Oh, no, please.
Do love a dance. I start to feel a bit wobbly if I haven't had a dance for a while.
Oh, well, no, you have to come along and sing. You know, people just sing so loudly. It's like I'm playing to a choir sometimes. You go to different places all around the country. You go to Wales and you're like, oh, my God. It's like this wall of sound hits you. And songs are emotional, you know.
Some sample tracks for anyone listening who wants to know the vibe. What kind of thing might you use?
Well, Rage Against the Machine. And that works. Some places it works, some places it doesn't. But when it works, it really works. You can just feel everybody just letting off steam. Don't Look Back in Anger is very emotional. It's always incredibly emotional when we do that. And people get their phones out. And I just think, wow, imagine if you were Noel Gallagher, what it's like doing a gig and hearing all those people. And for a fraction of, I know a little tiny bit of what it must be like to be Noel Gallagher. But it really shows you the power of music, because you can see how moved everybody is. And I always dedicate that to people who work for the NHS, and it's really important to do that.
Yeah. So that's the only song I'd have to go to the loo for, because my name's Sally and
I'm
used to drunken men shouting at it,
yeah.
Shouting at my face, those lyrics in pubs,
yeah.
As though they're the first ones to ever do it. Yeah, kind of gets boring quite quickly with my name Sally. But yes, I love a 90s anthem. I'll definitely come to that. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a joy to have you. You are every grown woman's favourite girl crush, I've discovered.
Oh, that's incredibly
kind. In the
run-up
to this recording, you were the one lots of women were like, oh my God, I love her. She's my woman crush. She's my girl crush.
That's so
embarrassing. Quite a responsibility.
It is. It is. I'll try to live up to it. I feel really bad because I forgot the girl who does my facials, who I think genuinely think is amazing, is called Georgina, and it's Skinfluence that she works for.
Is she on Instagram? We'll put her in the show notes.
Oh God, I've got to find out all that kind
I'll
of stuff.
I'll find her.
Okay, please do, and let people know.
She'll be on your follow list probably.
Yeah.
I'll find her.
And also, yeah, I mean, just because I really believe that people who work locally all around the country are really, really important, because I work in London, so you can go to lots of like these, you know, big facials and massage places. But those people who work and have that amazing touch are really important to shout about. So, yeah.
I think we didn't realise until COVID what vital parts of the community those businesses were.
Yeah, and how hard those women and men work to keep the businesses going, because it's incredibly hard. You know, as the recession's going on and people can't spend that much money, it's so hard to keep afloat. So yeah, they're very, very important.
Georgina, we're finding you. You're going in the show notes.
Thank you.
And we may even come for a facial at some point. Jo Wiley, thank you so much for coming. It's been heaven to talk to you again. And thank you so much for listening. Lots of other great conversations in the archive. Do go and have a look at those if you'd like to listen to them. And in the meantime, I will see you next time with another great guest. Lots of love. Bye. Beyond the Bathroom is written and hosted by me, Sally Hughes, and is an Insanity Studios production. The head of production is Charlotte Mason, the head of digital is Ed Buckley, and the production assistant is Abby Sandler.